This is Audible.
Scholastic Audio presents Five Nights at Freddy's, Book 1, The Silver Eyes, by Scott Cawthon and Kira Breed Risley. Read by Suzanne Elise Freeman. Chapter 1. He sees me. Charlie dropped to her hands and knees. She was wedged behind a row of arcade games, cramped in the crawl space between the consoles and the wall, tangled electrical cords and useless plugs strewn beneath her. She was cornered. The only way out was past the thing, and she wasn't fast enough to make it. She could see him stalking back and forth, catching flickers of movement through the gaps between the games. There was scarcely enough room to move, but she tried to crawl backward. Her foot caught on a cord. She stopped, contorting herself to carefully dislodge it. She heard the clash of metal on metal, and the farthest console rocked back against the wall. He hit it again, shattering the display, then attacked the next, crashing against them almost rhythmically, tearing through the machinery, coming closer. I have to get out. I have to. The panicked thought was of no help. There was no way out. Her arm ached, and she wanted to sob aloud. Blood soaked through the tattered bandage, and it seemed as though she could feel it draining out of her. The console a few feet away crashed against the wall, and Charlie flinched. He was getting closer. She could hear the grinding of gears and the clicking of servos, even louder. Eyes closed, she could still see the way he looked at her, see the matted fur and the exposed metal beneath the synthetic flesh. Suddenly, the console in front of her was wrenched away. It toppled over, thrown down like a toy. The power cords beneath her hands and knees were yanked away, and Charlie slipped, almost falling. She caught herself and looked up just in time to see the downward swing of a hook. Welcome to Hurricane Utah. Charlie smiled wryly at the sign and kept driving. The world didn't look any different from one side of the sign to the other, but she felt a nervous anticipation as she passed it. She didn't recognize anything. Then again, she hadn't really expected to, not this far at the edge of town where it was all highway and empty space. She wondered what the others would look like, who they were now. 10 years ago, they'd been best friends. And then it happened, and everything ended. At least for Charlie. She hadn't seen any of them since she was 7 years old. They had written all the time as kids, especially Marla, who wrote like she talked, fast and incoherent. But as they got older, they had grown apart. The letters had grown fewer and further between, and the conversations leading up to this trip had been perfunctory and full of awkward pauses. Charlie repeated their names as though to reassure herself that she still remembered them. Marla, Jessica, Lamar, Carlton, John, and Michael. Michael was the reason for this trip, after all. It was 10 years since he'd died. 10 years since it happened. And now his parents wanted them all together for the dedication ceremony. They wanted all his old friends there when they announced the scholarship they were creating in his name. Charlie knew it was a good thing to do, but the gathering still felt slightly macabre. She shivered and turned down the air conditioning, even though she knew it was not the cold. As she drove into the town center, Charlie began to recognize things. A few stores and the movie theater, which was now advertising the summer's blockbuster hit. She felt a brief moment of surprise, then smiled at herself. What did you expect? That the whole place would be unchanged? A monument to the moment of your departure, frozen forever in July 1985? Well, that was exactly what she had expected. She looked at her watch. Still a few hours to kill before they all met up. She thought about going to the movie, but she knew what she really wanted to do. Charlie made a left turn and headed out of town. 10 minutes later, she pulled to a stop and got out. The house loomed up before her, its dark outline a wound in the bright blue sky. Charlie leaned back against the car, slightly dizzy. She took a moment to steady herself with deep breaths. She had known it would be here. An illicit look through her aunt's bank books a few years before had told her that the mortgage was paid off and that Aunt Jen was still paying property taxes. It had only been 10 years. There was no reason it should have changed at all. Charlie climbed the steps slowly, taking in the peeling paint. The third stair still had a loose board, and the rose bushes had taken over one side of the porch, their thorns biting hungrily into the wood. The door was locked, but Charlie still had her key. She had never actually used it. As she took it from around her neck and slid it into the lock, she remembered her father putting its chain around her neck. In case you ever need it. Well, she needed it now. The door opened easily, and Charlie looked around. She didn't remember much about the first couple of years here. She had been only 3 years old, and all the memories had faded together in the blur of a child's grief and loss, of not understanding why her mother had to go away, clinging to her father every moment, not trusting the world around her unless he was there, unless she was holding tightly to him, burying herself in his flannel shirts and the smell of grease and hot metal and him. The stairs stretched straight up in front of her, but she did not move directly to them. Instead, she went into the living room, where all the furniture was still in place. She had not really noticed it as a child, but the house was a little too large for the furniture they had. Things were spread out too widely in order to fill the space. The coffee table was too far from the couch to reach, the easy chair too far across the room to carry on a conversation. There was a dark stain in the wooden floorboards near the center of the room. Charlie stepped around it quickly and went to the kitchen, where the cupboards held only a few pots, pans, and dishes. Charlie had never felt a lack of anything as a child, but it seemed now that the unnecessary enormity of the house was a sort of apology, the attempt of a man who had lost so much to give his daughter what he could. He'd always had a way of overdoing whatever he did. The last time she was here, the house had been dark and everything felt wrong. She was carried up the stairs to her bedroom, although she was 7 years old and could have gone quicker on her own 2 feet. But Aunt Jen had stopped on the front porch, picked her up, and carried her, shielding her face as though she were a baby in the glaring sun. In her room, Aunt Jen set Charlie down and closed the bedroom door behind them. She told her to pack her suitcase, and Charlie had cried because all her things could never fit into that small case. "We can come back for the rest later," Aunt Jen said, her impatience leaking through as Charlie hovered indecisively at her dresser, trying to decide which t-shirts to bring along. They had never come back for the rest. Charlie mounted the stairs, heading to her old bedroom. The door was partially cracked, and as she opened it, she had a giddy feeling of displacement, as though her younger self might be sitting there among her toys, might look up and ask Charlie, "Who are you?" Charlie went in. Like the rest of the house, her bedroom was untouched. The walls were pale pink, and the ceiling, which sloped dramatically on one side to follow the line of the roof, was painted to match. Her old bed still stood against the wall beneath a large window. The mattress was still intact, though the sheets were gone. The window was cracked slightly open, and rotting lace curtains wavered in the gentle breeze from outside. There was a dark water stain in the paint beneath the window where the weather had gotten in over the years, betraying the house's neglect. Charlie climbed onto the bed and forced the window shut. It obeyed with a screech, and Charlie stepped back and turned her attention to the rest of the room, to her father's creations. Their first night in the house, Charlie had been afraid to sleep alone. She did not remember the night, but her father had told her about it often enough that the story had taken on the quality of memory, She sat up and wailed until her father came to find her, until he scooped her up and held her and promised her he would make sure she was never alone again. The next morning, he took her by the hand and led her to the garage, where he set to work keeping that promise. The first of his inventions was a purple rabbit, now gray with age from years of sitting in the sunlight. Her father had named him Theodore. He was the size of a 3-year-old child, her size at the time, and he had plush fur, shining eyes, and a dapper red bow tie. He didn't do much, only waved a hand, tilted his head to the side, and said in her father's voice, "I love you, Charlie." But it was enough to give her a night watcher, someone to keep her company when she could not sleep. Right now, Theodore sat in a white wicker chair in the far corner of the room. Charlie waved at him, but, not activated, he did not wave back. After Theodore, the toys got more complex. Some worked and some did not. Some seemed to have permanent glitches, while others simply did not appeal to Charlie's childish imagination. She knew her father took those back to his workshop and recycled them for parts, though she did not like to watch them be dismantled. But the ones that were kept, those she loved. They were here now, looking at her expectantly. Smiling, Charlie pushed a button beside her bed. It gave way stiffly, but nothing happened. She pushed it again, holding it down longer, and this time, across the room and with the weary creak of metal on metal, the unicorn began to move. The unicorn, Charlie had named him Stanley for some reason she could no longer remember, was made of metal and had been painted glossy white. He trundled around the room on a circular track, bobbing his head stiffly up and down. The track squealed as Stanley rounded the corner and came to a stop beside the bed. Charlie knelt beside him on the floor and patted his flank. His glossy paint was chipped and peeling, and his face had given over to rust. His eyes were lively, gazing out of the decay. "You need a new coat of paint, Stanley," Charlie said. The unicorn stared ahead, unresponsive. At the foot of the bed, there was a wheel. Made of patched-together metal, it had always reminded her of something she might find on a submarine. Charlie turned it. It stuck for a moment, then gave way, rotating as it always did, and across the room the smallest closet door swung open. Out sailed Ella on her track, a child-sized doll bearing a teacup and saucer in her tiny hands like an offering. Ella's plaid dress was still crisp, and her patent leather shoes still shone. Perhaps the closet had protected her from the damage of the damp. Charlie had had an identical outfit, back when she and Ella were the same height. "Hi, Ella," she said softly. As the wheel unwound, Ella retreated to the closet again, the door closing behind her. Charlie followed her. The closets had been built to align with the slant of the ceiling, and there were three of them. Ella lived in the short one, which was about 3.5 feet tall. Next to it was one a foot or so taller, and a third, closest to the bedroom door, was the same height as the rest of the room. She smiled, remembering. "Why do you have three closets?" John had demanded the first time he came over. She looked at him blankly, confused by the question.
"'Cause that's how many there are," she said finally.
She pointed defensively to the littlest one.
"That one's Ella's anyway," she added.
John nodded, satisfied. Charlie shook her head and opened the door to the middle closet, or tried to. The knob stopped with a jolt. It was locked. She rattled it a few times but gave up without much conviction. She stayed crouched low to the floor and glanced up at the tallest closet, her big girl closet that she would someday grow into.
"You won't need it until you're bigger," her father would say.
But that day never came. The door now hung open slightly, but Charlie didn't disturb it. It hadn't opened for her. It had only given way to time. As she moved to stand, she noticed something shiny, half hidden under the rim of the locked middle door. She leaned forward to pick it up. It looked like a broken-off piece of a circuit board. She smiled slightly. Nuts, bolts, scraps, and parts had turned up all over the place once upon a time. Her father always had stray parts in his pockets. He would carry around something he was working on, set it down, and forget where it was. Or worse, put something aside for safekeeping, never to be seen again. There was also a strand of her hair clinging to it. She unwound it carefully from the tiny lip of metal it was stuck on. Finally, as though she had been putting it off, Charlie crossed the room and picked up Theodore. His back had not faded in the sun like the front of his body, and it was the same rich, dark purple she remembered. She pressed the button at the base of his neck, but he remained lifeless. His fur was threadbare, one ear hanging loose by a single, rotting thread, and through the hole she could see the green plastic of his circuit board. Charlie held her breath, listening fearfully for something.
"Lee," the rabbit said with a barely audible halting noise, and Charlie set him down, her face hot and her chest pinched tight.
She had not really expected to hear her father's voice again.
"I love you too."
Charlie looked around the room. When she was a child, it had been her own magical world, and she was possessive of it. Only a few chosen friends were ever even allowed inside. She went to her bed and set Stanley moving on his track again. She left, closing the door behind her before the little unicorn came to a halt. She went out the back door to the driveway and stopped in front of the garage that had been her father's workshop. Half buried in the gravel a few feet away was a piece of metal, and Charlie went to pick it up. It was jointed in the middle, and she held it in her hands, smiling a little as she bent it back and forth.
An elbow joint, she thought. I wonder who that was going to belong to.
She had stood in this exact spot many times before. She closed her eyes, and the memory overwhelmed her. She was a little girl again, sitting on the floor of her father's workshop, playing with scraps of wood and metal as though they were toy blocks, trying to build a tower with the uneven pieces. The shop was hot, and she was sweaty, grime sticking to her legs as she sat in her shorts and sneakers. She could almost smell the sharp, metallic odor of the soldering iron. Her father was nearby, never out of sight, working on Stanley the unicorn. Stanley's face was still unfinished, one side white and shining and friendly, with a gleaming brown eye that seemed almost to see. The other half of the toy's face was all exposed circuit boards and metal parts. Charlie's father looked at her and smiled, and she smiled back, beloved. In a darkened corner behind her father, barely visible, hung a jumble of metal limbs, a twisted skeleton with burning silver eyes. Every once in a while, it gave an uncanny twitch. Charlie tried never to look at it, but as her father worked, as she played with her makeshift toys, her eye was drawn back to it again and again. The limbs, contorted, seemed almost mocking, the thing a ghastly jester, and yet there was something about it that suggested enormous pain.
"Daddy?"
Charlie said, and her father did not look up from his work.
"Daddy?"
she said again, more urgently, and this time he turned to her slowly, as though not fully present in the world.
"What do you need, sweetie?"
She pointed at the metal skeleton.
"Does it hurt?"
She wanted to ask the question, but when she looked into her father's eyes, she found she could not. She shook her head.
"Nothing."
He nodded at her with an absent smile and went back to his work. Behind him, the creature gave another awful twitch, and its eyes still burned. Charlie shivered and drew herself back to the present. She glanced behind her, feeling exposed. She looked down, and her gaze fixed on something. three widely spaced grooves in the ground. She knelt, thoughtful, and ran her finger over one of them. The gravel was scattered away, the marks worn heavily into the dirt. A camera tripod of some sort? It was the first unfamiliar thing she'd seen. The door to the workshop was cracked open slightly, inviting, but she felt no desire to go inside. Quickly, she headed back to her car, but she stopped as soon as she settled into the driver's seat. Her keys were gone, having probably fallen out of her pocket somewhere inside the house. She retraced her steps, merely glancing into the living room and kitchen before heading up to her bedroom. The keys were on the wicker chair, beside Theodore the rabbit. She picked them up and jangled them for a moment, not quite ready to leave the room behind. She sat down on the bed. Stanley the unicorn had stopped beside the bed as he always did, and as she sat, she patted him absently on the head. It had grown dark while she was outside, and the room was now cast in shadows. Somehow, without the bright sunlight, the toy's flaws and deterioration were thrown into sharp relief. Theodore's eyes no longer shone, and his thin fur and hanging ear made him look like a sickly vagabond. When she looked down at Stanley, the rust around his eyes made them look like hollow sockets, and his bared teeth, which she had always thought of as a smile, became the awful, knowing grin of a skull. Charlie stood up, careful not to touch him, and hurried toward the door, but her foot caught on the wheel beside the bed. She tripped on the tracks and fell sprawling to the floor. There was a whir of spinning metal, and as she raised her head, a small pair of feet appeared under her nose, clad in shining patent leather. She looked up. There above her was Ella, staring down at her, silent and uninvited, her glassy eyes almost appearing to see. The teacup and saucer were held out before her with a military stiffness. Charlie got up cautiously, taking care not to disturb the doll. She left the room, stepping carefully to avoid accidentally activating any other toys. As Charlie went, Ella retreated to her closet, almost matching her pace. Charlie hurried down the stairs, seized by an urgency to get away. In the car, she fumbled the key three times before sliding it into place. She backed too fast down the driveway, running recklessly over the grass of the front yard, and sped away. After about a mile, Charlie pulled over on the shoulder and turned the car off, staring straight ahead through the windshield, her eyes focused on nothing. She forced herself to breathe slowly. She reached up and adjusted the rearview mirror so she could see herself. She always expected to see pain, anger, and sorrow written on her face, but they never were. Her cheeks were pink, and her round face looked almost cheerful, like always. Her first weeks living with Aunt Jen, she heard the same things over and over when Aunt Jen introduced her. "What a pretty child. What a happy-looking child she is." Charlie always looked like she was about to smile, her brown eyes wide and sparkling, her thin mouth ready to curve up, even when she wanted to sob. The incongruity was a mild betrayal. She ran her fingers through her light brown hair as though that would magically fix its slight frizziness and put the mirror back into position. She turned the car back on and searched for a radio station, hoping music might bring her fully back to reality. She flipped from station to station, not really hearing what any of them were playing, and finally settled on an AM broadcast with a host who seemed to be yelling condescendingly at his audience. She had no idea what he was talking about, but the brash and annoying sound was enough to jar her back into the present. The clock in the car was always wrong, so she checked her watch. It was almost time to meet her friends at the diner they had chosen, near the center of town. Charlie pulled back onto the road and drove, letting the sound of the angry talk radio host soothe her mind. When she reached the restaurant, Charlie pulled into the lot and stopped, but did not park. The front of the diner had a long picture window all across it, and she could see right inside. Though she had not seen them for years, it took her only a moment to spot her friends through the glass. Jessica was easiest to pick out from the crowd. She always enclosed pictures with her letters, and right now she looked exactly like her last photo. Even seated, she was clearly taller than either of the boys, and very thin. Though Charlie could not see her whole outfit, she was wearing a loose white shirt with an embroidered vest, and she had a brimmed hat perched on her glossy, shoulder-length brown hair, with an enormous flower threatening to tip it off her head. She was gesturing excitedly about something as she spoke. The two boys were sitting next to each other, facing her. Carlton looked like an older version of his red-headed childhood self. He still had a bit of a baby face, but his features had refined, and his hair was carefully tousled and held in place by some alchemical hair product. He was almost pretty, for a boy, and he wore a black workout shirt, though she doubted he'd ever worked out a day in his life. He slouched forward on the table, resting his chin in his hands. Beside him, John sat closest to the window. John had been the kind of child who got dirty before he even went outside. There would be paint on his shirt before the teacher handed out the watercolors, grass stains on his knees before they came near a playground, and dirt under his fingernails just after he washed his hands. Charlie knew it was him because it had to be, but he looked completely different. The grubbiness of childhood had been replaced by something crisp and clean. He was wearing a neatly pressed, light green button-down shirt, the sleeves rolled up and the collar open, preventing him from looking too uptight. He was leaning back confidently in the booth, nodding enthusiastically, apparently absorbed in whatever Jessica was saying. The only concession to his former self was his hair, sticking up all over his head, and he had a 5 o'clock shadow, a smug, adult version of the dirt he was always covered in as a kid. Charlie smiled to herself. John had been something like her childhood crush, before either of them really understood what that meant. He gave her cookies from his Transformers lunchbox, and once in kindergarten he took the blame when she broke the glass jar that held colored beads for arts and crafts. She remembered the moment when it slipped from her hands, and she watched it fall. She could not have moved fast enough to catch it, but she would not have tried. She wanted to see it break. The glass hit the wood floor and shattered into a thousand pieces, and the beads scattered, many-colored, among the shards. She thought it was beautiful, and then she started to cry. John had a note sent home to his parents, and when she told him thank you, he had winked at her with an irony beyond his years and simply said, "For what?" After that, John was allowed to come to her room. She let him play with Stanley and Theodore, watching anxiously the first time he learned to press the buttons and make them move. She would be crushed if he didn't like them, knowing instinctively that it would make her think less of him. They were her family. But John was fascinated as soon as he saw them. He loved her mechanical toys, and so she loved him. 2 years later, behind a tree beside her father's workshop, she almost let him kiss her. And then it happened, and everything ended, at least for Charlie. Charlie shook herself, forcing her mind back to the present. Looking again at Jessica's polished appearance, she glanced down at herself. Purple t-shirt, denim jacket, black jeans, and combat boots. It had felt like a good choice this morning, but now she wished she had chosen something else. "This is all you ever wear," she reminded herself. She parked and locked the car behind her, even though people in Hurricane did not usually lock their cars. Then she went into the diner to meet her friends for the first time in 10 years. The warmth, noise, and light of the restaurant hit her in a wave as she entered. For a moment she was overwhelmed, but Jessica saw her pause in the doorway and shouted her name. Charlie smiled and went over. "Hi," she said awkwardly, flicking her eyes at each of them but not fully making contact. Jessica scooted over on the red vinyl bench and patted the seat beside her. "Here, sit," she said, I was just telling John and Carlton about my glamorous life.
She rolled her eyes as she said it, managing to convey both self-deprecation and the sense that her life was truly something exciting.
Did you know Jessica lives in New York? Carlton said.
There was something careful about the way he spoke, like he was thinking about his words before he formed them. John was silent, but he smiled at Charlie anxiously. Jessica rolled her eyes again, and with a flash of déjà vu, Charlie suddenly recalled that this had been a habit even when they were children.
8 million people live in New York, Carlton. It's not exactly an achievement, Jessica said.
Carlton shrugged.
I've never been anywhere, he said.
I didn't know you still lived in town, Charlie said.
Where else am I going to live? My family has been here since 1896,
he added, deepening his voice to mimic his father.
Is that even true? Charlie asked.
I don't know, Carlton said in his own register. Could be. Dad ran for mayor 2 years ago. I mean, he lost, but still, who runs for mayor?
He made a face.
I swear, the day I turn 18, I am out of here.
Where are you going to go? John asked, looking seriously at Carlton. Carlton met his eyes, just as serious for a moment. Abruptly, he broke away and pointed out the window, closing one eye as if to get his aim true. John raised an eyebrow as he looked out the window, trying to follow the line Carlton was pointing to. Charlie looked, too. Carlton wasn't pointing at anything. John opened his mouth to say something, but Carlton interrupted.
Or,
he said as he smoothly pointed in the opposite direction.
Okay.
John scratched his head, looking slightly embarrassed.
Anywhere, right?
He added with a laugh.
Where's everyone else? Charlie asked, peering out the window and searching the parking lot for new arrivals.
Tomorrow, John said.
They're coming tomorrow morning, Jessica jumped in to clarify. Marla's bringing her little brother. Can you believe it?
Jason? Charlie smiled. She remembered Jason as a little bundle of blankets with a tiny red face peeking out.
I mean, who wants a baby around?
Jessica adjusted her hat primly.
I'm pretty sure he's not a baby anymore, Charlie said, stifling a laugh. Practically a baby, Jessica said. Anyway, I booked us a room at the motel down by the highway. It was all I could find. The boys are staying with Carlton.
Okay, Charlie said. She was vaguely impressed by Jessica's organization, but she wasn't happy about the plan. She was loath to share a room with Jessica, who now seemed like a stranger. Jessica had become the kind of girl who intimidated her, polished and immaculate, speaking as though she had everything in life figured out. For a moment, Charlie considered going back to her old house for the night, but as soon as she thought it, the idea repelled her. That house, at night, was no longer the province of the living.
Don't be dramatic, she scolded herself.
But now John was speaking. He had a way of commanding attention with his voice, probably because he spoke less often than everyone else. He spent most of his time listening, but not out of reticence. He was gathering information, speaking only when he had wisdom or sarcasm to dispense. Often it was both at once.
Does anyone know what's happening tomorrow?
They were all silent for a moment, and the waitress took the opportunity to come over for their order. Charlie flipped quickly through the menu, her eyes not really focusing on the words. Her turn to order came much faster than she was expecting, and she froze.
Eggs, she said at last.
The woman's hard expression was still fixed on her, and she realized she had not finished.
Scrambled, wheat toast, she added, and the woman went away.
Charlie looked back down at the menu. She hated this about herself. When she was caught off guard, she seemed to lose all ability to act or process what was going on around her. People were incomprehensible, their demands alien.
Ordering dinner shouldn't be hard, she thought.
The others had begun their conversation again,
and she turned her attention to them, feeling like she had fallen behind.
What do we even say to his parents? Jessica was saying.
Carlton, do you ever see them? Charlie asked.
Not really, he said. Around, I guess. Sometimes.
I'm surprised they stayed in Hurricane, Jessica said with a note of worldly disapproval in her voice.
Charlie said nothing, but she thought, how could they not? His body had never been found. How could they not have secretly hoped he might come home, no matter how impossible they knew it was? How could they leave the only home Michael knew? It would mean really, finally giving up on him. Maybe that was what this scholarship was, an admission that he was never coming home. Charlie was acutely aware that they were in a public place, where talking about Michael felt inappropriate. They were, in a sense, both insiders and outsiders. They had been closer to Michael, probably more than anyone in this restaurant, but, with the exception of Carlton, they were no longer from Hurricane. They did not belong. She saw the tears falling on her paper placemat before she felt them, and she hurriedly wiped her eyes, looking down and hoping no one had noticed. When she looked up, John appeared to be studying his silverware, but she knew he had seen. She was grateful to him for not trying to offer comfort.
John, do you still write? Charlie asked.
John had declared himself an author when they were about six, having learned to read and write when he was four, a year ahead of the rest of them. At the age of seven, he completed his first novel and pressed his poorly spelled, inscrutably illustrated creation on his friends and family, demanding reviews. Charlie remembered that she had given him only 2 stars. John laughed at the question.
I actually do my E's the right way these days, he said. I can't believe you remember that. But I do, actually, yeah.
He stopped, clearly wanting to say more.
What do you write?
Carlton obliged, and John looked down at his placemat, speaking mostly to the table.
Short stories, mostly. I actually had one published last year. I mean, it was just in a magazine, nothing big.
They all made suitable noises of being impressed, and he looked up again, embarrassed but pleased.
What was the story about? Charlie asked.
John hesitated, but before he could speak or decide not to, the waitress returned with their food. They had all ordered from the breakfast menu. Coffee, eggs and bacon, blueberry pancakes for Carlton. The brightly colored food looked hopeful, like a fresh start to the day. Charlie took a bite of her toast and they all ate silently for a moment.
Hey, Carlton, John said suddenly. Whatever happened to Freddy's anyway?
There was a brief hush. Carlton looked nervously at Charlie, and Jessica stared up at the ceiling. John flushed red, and Charlie spoke hastily.
It's okay, Carlton. I'd like to know, too.
Carlton shrugged, stabbing at his pancakes nervously with his fork.
They built over it, he said.
What did they build?
Jessica asked.
Is there something else there now? Was it built over or just torn down?
John asked. Carlton shrugged again, quick, like a nervous tick.
Like I said, I don't know. It's too far back from the road to see, and I haven't exactly investigated. It might have been leased to someone, but I don't know what they did. It's all been blocked off for years, under construction. You can't even tell if the building is still there.
So it could still be there?
Jessica asked with a spark of excitement breaking through.
Like I said, I don't know, Carlton answered.
Charlie felt the diner's fluorescent lights glaring down on her face, suddenly too bright. She felt exposed. She had barely eaten, but she found herself rising from the booth, pulling a few crumpled bills from her pocket, and dropping them on the table.
I'm going to go outside for a minute, she said. Smoke break, she added hastily.
You don't smoke.
She chided herself for the clumsy lie as she made her way to the door, jostling past a family of four without saying excuse me, and stepped out into the cool evening. She walked to her car and sat on the hood, the metal denting slightly under her weight. She took in breaths of the cool air as if it were water, and closed her eyes. "You knew it would come up. You knew you would have to talk about it," she reminded herself. She had practiced on the drive here, had forced herself to think back to happy memories, to smile and say, "Remember when?" She thought she was prepared for this, but of course she had been wrong. Why else would she have run out of the restaurant like a child? "Charlie?" She opened her eyes and saw John standing next to the car, holding her jacket out in front of him like an offering. "You forgot your jacket," he said, and she made herself smile at him. "Thanks," she said. She took it and draped it over her shoulders, then slid over on the car's hood for him to sit. "Sorry about that," she said. In the dim lights of the parking lot, she could still see him blush to the ears. He joined her on the car's hood, leaving a deliberate space between them. "I haven't learned to think before I talk. I'm sorry." John watched the sky as a plane passed overhead. Charlie smiled, this time unforced. "It's okay. I knew it was going to come up. It had to. It sounds stupid, but I never think about it. I don't let myself. No one knows what happened except my aunt, and we never talk about it. Then I come here and suddenly it's everywhere. I was just surprised, that's all." "Uh-oh," John pointed, and Charlie saw Jessica and Carlton hesitating in the doorway of the diner. She waved them over, and they came. "Remember that time at Freddy's when the merry-go-round got stuck? And Marla and that mean kid Billy had to keep riding in until their parents plucked them off?" Charlie said. John laughed, and the sound made her smile. Their faces were bright red, crying like babies. She covered her face, guilty that it was so funny to her. There was a brief, surprised silence, then Carlton started laughing. "Then Marla puked all over him." "Sweet justice," Charlie said. "Actually, I think it was nachos," John added. Jessica wrinkled her nose.
"So gross. I never wrote it again. Not after that."
"Oh, come on, Jessica. They cleaned it," said Carlton. "I'm pretty sure kids puked all over that place. Those wet floor signs weren't there for nothing. Right, Charlie?"
"Don't look at me," she said. "I never puked. We used to spend so much time there. Privileges of knowing the owner's daughter," Jessica said, looking at Charlie with mock accusation. "I couldn't help who my dad was," Charlie said, laughing. Jessica looked thoughtful for a moment before she continued.
"I mean, how could you have a better childhood than spending all day at Freddy Fazbear's Pizza?"
"I don't know," said Carlton. "I think that music got to me over the years."
He hummed a few bars of the familiar song. Charlie dipped her head to it, recalling the tune.
"I love those animals so much," Jessica said suddenly. "What's the proper term for them? Animals? Robots? Mascots?"
"I think those are all accurate," Charlie leaned back.
"Well, anyway, I used to go and talk to the bunny. What was his name?"
"Bonnie," Charlie said.
"Yeah,"
said Jessica.
"I used to complain to him about my parents. I always thought he had an understanding look about him."
Carlton laughed.
"Animatronic therapy, recommended by 6 out of 7 crazy people."
"Shut up," Jessica retorted. "I knew he wasn't real. I just liked talking to him."
Charlie smiled a little.
"I remember that," she said.
Jessica, in her prim little dresses, her brown hair in 2 tight braids like a little kid out of an old book, walking up to the stage when the show was over, whispering earnestly to the life-size animatronic rabbit. If anyone came up beside her, she went instantly silent and still, waiting for them to go away so she could resume her one-sided conversations. Charlie had never talked to the animals at her father's restaurant, or felt close to them like some kids seemed to. Although she liked them, they belonged to the public. She had her own toys, mechanical friends waiting for her at home, that belonged only to her.
"I liked Freddy," said John. "He always seemed the most relatable. You know, there are a lot of things about my childhood that I can't remember at all," Carlton said. "But I swear, I can close my eyes and see every last detail of that place, even the gum I used to stick under the tables."
"Gum? Yeah, right. Those were boogers." Jessica took a tiny step away from Carlton. He grinned.
"I was 7. What do you want? You all picked on me back then. Remember when Marla wrote, 'Carlton smells like feet' on the wall outside?"
"You did smell like feet," Jessica laughed with a sudden outburst. Carlton shrugged, unperturbed.
"I used to try to hide when it was time to go home. I wanted to be stuck in there overnight so I could have the whole place to myself." "Yeah, you always kept everyone waiting," said John. "And you always hid under the same table."
Charlie spoke slowly, and when she did, everyone turned to her, as though they had been waiting. "Sometimes I feel like I remember every inch of it, like Carlton," she said. "But sometimes it's like I hardly remember it at all. It's all in pieces. Like, I remember the carousel and that time it got stuck. I remember drawing on the placemats. I remember little things. Eating that greasy pizza, hugging Freddy in the summer and his yellow fur getting stuck all over my clothes. But a lot of it is like pictures. Like it happened to someone else." They were all looking at her oddly.
"Freddy was brown, right?"
Jessica looked to the others for confirmation.
"I guess you really don't remember it that well after all,"
Carlton teased Charlie, and she laughed briefly.
"Right, I meant brown," she said. "Brown. Freddy was brown. Of course he was. She could see him in her mind now. But somewhere in the depths of her recall, there was a flash of something else."
Carlton launched into another story, and Charlie tried to turn her attention to him, but there was something disturbing, worrisome, about that lapse in memory.
"It was 10 years ago. It's not like you've got dementia at 17, she told herself, but it was such a basic detail to have misremembered.
Out of the corner of her eye, she caught John looking at her, a pensive expression on his face, as though she had said something important.
"You really don't know what happened to it?"
she asked Carlton with more urgency in her voice than she intended. He stopped talking, surprised.
"Sorry," she said. "Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you."
"It's okay," he said. "But yeah, or no, I really don't know what happened."
"How can you not know? You live here."
"Charlie, come on," said John. "It's not like I hang around that part of town. Things are different. The town has grown,"
Carlton said mildly, seeming unruffled by her outburst.
"And I honestly don't look for reasons to go around there, you know? Why would I? There isn't any reason. Not anymore." "We could go there," John said suddenly, and Charlie's heart skipped.
Carlton looked nervously at Charlie.
"What? Seriously, it's a mess. I don't know if you can even get to it."
Charlie found herself nodding. She felt as though she had spent the whole day weighed down by memory, seeing everything through a filter of years, and now she felt suddenly alert, her mind fully present. She wanted to go.
"Let's do it," she said. "Even if there's nothing there, I want to see."
They were all silent. Suddenly, John smiled with a reckless confidence.
"Yeah, let's do it."
Chapter 2. Charlie pulled to a stop, feeling the soft give of dirt under her tires, and turned off the car. She got out and surveyed their surroundings. The sky was a rich, dark blue, the last trails of the sunset streaking off to the west. The parking lot was unpaved, and before them lay a sprawling monster of a building, a rising acre of glass and concrete. There were lamps in the parking lot that had never been used, and no lights shone out onto the lot. The building itself looked like an abandoned sanctuary, entombed in black trees amid the distant roar of civilization. She looked at Jessica in the passenger seat, who was craning her neck out the window.
"Is this the right place?"
Jessica asked. Charlie shook her head slowly, not quite certain what she was seeing.
"I don't know," she whispered.
Charlie got out of the car and stood in silence as John and Carlton pulled up beside her.
"What is this?"
John stepped out of the car cautiously and stared blankly at the monument.
"Does anyone have a flashlight?"
He looked at each of them. Carlton held up his keychain and waved around the feeble glow of a penlight for a minute.
"Great," John muttered,
walking away with resignation.
"Hold on a sec," Charlie said and went around to her trunk. "My aunt makes me carry around a bunch of stuff for emergencies."
Aunt Jen, loving but severe, had taught Charlie self-reliance above almost anything else. Before she let Charlie have her old blue Honda, she had insisted that Charlie know how to change a tire, check the oil, and know the basic parts of the engine. In the trunk, in a black box tucked in next to the jack, spare tire, and small crowbar, she had a blanket, a heavy police-issue flashlight, bottled water, granola bars, matches, and emergency flares. Charlie grabbed the flashlight. Carlton grabbed a granola bar. Almost by silent agreement, they began to walk the building's perimeter, Charlie holding up the light in a steady beam in front of them. The building itself looked mostly finished, but the ground was all dirt and rock, uneven and soft. Charlie shone the light on the ground, where grass had grown patchy in the dirt, inches long.
"No one has been digging for a while," Charlie said. The place was massive, and it took a long time to circumnavigate.
It wasn't long before the rich blue of the evening was overtaken by a blanket of scattered silver clouds and stars. The surfaces of the building were all the same smooth, beige concrete, with windows too high up on the walls to see inside.
"Did they really build this whole thing and then just leave?" Jessica said.
"Carlton," said John, "you really don't know anything about what happened?"
Carlton shrugged expansively.
"I told you. I knew there was construction, but I don't know anything else." "Why would they do this?"
John seemed almost paranoid, scouting the trees as though eyes might be looking back at him.
"It just goes on and on."
He squinted, gazing along the outside wall of the building, which seemed to stretch endlessly into the distance. He glanced back to the trees as if making sure they hadn't missed a building somehow.
"No, it was here."
He placed his hand on the drab concrete facing.
"It's gone."
After a moment, he gestured to the others and began to walk back the way they came. Reluctantly, Charlie turned back, following the group. They kept going until they could see their cars again up ahead in the darkness.
"Sorry, guys. I hope there would at least be something familiar," Carlton said exhaustedly.
"Yeah," Charlie said.
She had known it would be, but seeing that Freddy's had been razed to the ground was still a shock. It was so paramount, sometimes, in her mind, that she wanted to get rid of it, wanted to scrub the memories, good and bad, from her head, as if they had never been. Now someone had scrubbed it from the landscape, and it felt like a violation. It should have been up to her.
"Right," she thought, "because you had the money to buy it and preserve it, like Aunt Jen did with the house."
"Charlie?"
John was saying her name, and it sounded like he was repeating it.
"Sorry," she said. "What were you saying?"
Do you want to go inside?
Jessica asked. Charlie was surprised they were only now considering this, but then again, none of them was usually prone to criminal activity. The thought was a release, and she took a deep breath, speaking on her exhale.
Why not? She said, almost laughing.
She hefted the flashlight. Her arms were getting tired. Anyone else want to turn? She waved it back and forth like a pendulum. Carlton grabbed it and took a moment to appreciate its weight.
Why is this so heavy?
He said, passing it off to John.
Here you go.
It's a police flashlight, Charlie said absently. You can hit people with it. Jessica wrinkled her nose.
Your aunt really wasn't kidding around, huh? Ever used it?
Not yet. Charlie winked and made a half-threatening glance at John, who returned an uncertain half-smile, unsure how to react. The wide entrances were sealed with hammered metal doors, no doubt intended to be temporary until construction was finished. Still, it wasn't difficult to find a way in, since many large mounds of gravel and sand scaled the walls, leading right up to the edges of the large, gaping windows.
Not trying hard to keep people out, John said.
What's anyone going to steal? Charlie said, staring at the blank, towering walls. They climbed the hills slowly, the gravel shifting and sliding beneath their feet as they went. Carlton reached the window first and peered through. Jessica looked over his shoulder.
Can we drop down? John asked. Yes, said Carlton.
No,
Jessica said at precisely the same time.
I'll go, Charlie said. She felt reckless.
Without looking through to see how far the fall was, she put her feet through the opening and let herself drop. She landed, knees bent. The impact rocked her, but it did not hurt. She looked up at her friends staring down.
Oh, hang on,
Charlie called, pulling a short stepladder from a wall nearby and setting it under the window.
Okay, she said. Come on.
They dropped down one by one and looked around them. Inside was an atrium, or maybe it would have become a food court, with metal benches and plastic tables scattered around, some bolted to the floor. The ceiling rose up high above them, with a glass roof where they could see the stars peering down at them.
Very post-apocalyptic, Charlie joked, her voice echoing in the open space.
Jessica sang a brief, wordless scale suddenly, startling them all into silence. Her voice rang out pure and clear, something beautiful in the emptiness.
Very nice, but let's not call too much attention to ourselves, John said.
Right,
Jessica said, still very happy with herself. As they walked on, Carlton swept up and took her arm.
Your voice is amazing, he said.
It's just good acoustics, Jessica said,
attempting humility but not meaning a word of it. They walked the empty halls, peering into each of the massive cavities where a department store might have been. Some parts of the mall had been almost finished, while others were in shambles. Some hallways were littered with piles of dusty concrete bricks and stacks of wood. Others were lined with glass-paneled storefronts, lights hanging in perfect rows above their heads.
It's like a lost city, John said.
Like Pompeii, said Jessica. Just without the volcano.
No, Charlie said. There's nothing here. The whole place had a sterile feel to it. It was not abandoned. It had never sustained life at all. She looked in a store window across from her, one of the few with glass, wondering what would have been displayed. She imagined mannequins, dressed in bright clothing, but when she tried to picture them, all she could see was blank faces, concealing something. She suddenly felt out of place, unwelcomed by the building itself. Charlie began to feel restless, some of the luster wearing off the adventure. They had come. Freddy's was gone, and so was the shrine she had kept in her thoughts.
where she could still find Michael playing where she last saw him. John stopped suddenly, turning off the flashlight as carefully as he could. He put a finger to his lips, motioning for silence.